This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 133. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
0208 816 7691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and I'm joined this week by the boss, Mark Garraway. So before we get the show started, we're going to go straight to the plush chief executive offices at Pitch Vision Towers to join the boss to find out about an announcement that he's making this week. Over to you, boss.
Thank you, David. Well, I'm very pleased to formally announce that none other than Mark Garraway is joining the Academy in a formal role, and Mark's coming on board for a really exciting new project that's going to expand the range and the depth of resources that we provide into both the player and the coaching fraternity. In particular, Mark's coming on board to set up a whole new area in the Academy relating to coach education. And so with no further ado, Mark, welcome aboard.
Thank you, boss. Very good to be part of it. And as you said, we had a little intro last week, and which I very much enjoyed, and it's had a good reaction around the place as well. So very much looking to build upon that.
Yeah, and I think it's an amazing new phase for all of our community and all the listeners. You know the great work that David's been doing over the last four or five years now, and how we've built up the Academy. And I think this is really, really good logical extension of what we've been doing, in that we've got a bundle of resources for coaches and for players, but to now specialise out and to give a whole bit of new extra resource to some really specific independent coaching advice, and hopefully become the same sort of hub for coaches right up to the professional level that we are already for grassroots cricket.
And I just want to add that it's something that I've been wanting to have on the site for a long time now, because coaches are, you know, a big section of the community already, and that's without us really even focusing on coaches. So, Mark, it's great to have you and your experience on board. What do you think? What are you looking to achieve from the coach education section on the site?
Well, the main aim really is that for every coach, and we all know club coaches and school coaches come across so many different players over the course of their careers in coaching. And you look at your average club coach, and he's probably working with somewhere in the region of 80, 90 players at each club. So any information that we can help give to that coach, that male or female coach, will then be spread amongst, significant numbers.
I think the other interesting thing about it too is that we all know that both the ECB, Cricket Australia, and the BCCI and other groups, they already do, you know, invest quite heavily in coach education, and they do have very solid coach education programs. And we're not really trying to directly compete with those. We're, I guess, trying to provide an alternative resource, perhaps come at things at a slightly different angle. I guess you can say it's going to be really complementary to the formal resources that are out there.
And that's very true. I mean, I've been sitting on a body called the National Source Group, which puts together all the coach education programs throughout the British Isles and throughout Europe. And one of the key things that they've done is built the formal pillars of coach education, but they're very much going down the informal learning as well, which supplements that formal learning. And it's called, you know, continual professional development or continual personal development. And I see the Pitch Vision Academy website being exactly that, it being a port of call for any coach that wants to continue to learn beyond their formal learning on a level one, a level two, or a level three.
And in a way, we'll be those people who aren't quite in the system or in countries or regions that aren't covered by the formal ECB or association learning systems will probably be one of the key sources of coach education outside those main structures as well. So I think it's great.
Yeah, certainly an exciting time, and we don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much, because there's some other things going on in cricket as well. So let's have a little chat about some of the other things that have been going on in cricket this week. I'm especially interested in something where I'm sure there's a joke in it somewhere, but unfortunately, my funny bone is not very long, which is that the DRS system, the decision review system for the upcoming Pakistan series, is going to be sponsored by Pepsi. presumably because the Pakistan Cricket Board couldn't quite afford to pay the many, many thousands of pounds for hotspots. So what do you think of that, Gareth? Is the DRS the way to be going in international cricket?
Well, I like it, actually, I have to say. And I think as a both somebody who's been a support staff member and involved in the games of cricket that it's been used at, but also as a spectator, I think it adds a real bit of value to cricket. And I think the decisions that have been made have been generally good ones. You get the odd one, but then we had the odd one when the DRS wasn't involved as well. And the other thing that I think it's proven as well is how good these umpires are. You know, the elite panel now are operating a hugely enhanced level of pressure, but they're coping with it. And that's a really good thing to see, because as well as players improving and pitches improving and all of those things that you need, we also need our officials to be doing it as well. And I think it initially put people under pressure, but actually what it's shown is that we've got a really good elite band of umpires that go around the world doing the games. And it now makes that aspirational for other umpires in domestic cricket to get up to those levels. I think it's a real win-win for cricket.
It's I think you're right about the quality of umpiring. It really does reveal how good the umpires are in the vast majority of cases. But I guess the interesting question is, you can understand the cost explanation for it not being adopted universally. That's a fair enough reason. But for in the case of India, for example, you know, cost shouldn't be a consideration. You're a little bit closer to the Indian game than some of us, Gareth. So what do you think lies at the heart of the resistance there to DRS?
I think probably they've had some bad experiences, and one of the things in India is that everybody remembers those bad experiences as well. But I sense that there's a bit of a shift, because Duncan Fletcher was one of the big guys that put this idea up in the first place. And if you talk to Fletcher, he'd say that he was the guy that put it up there to start off with, and how to use Hawkeye and all of those things. And it's going to change. It's going to evolve because the systems get better, and their resistance. You know, it'll be interesting to see if their resistance is still there in 2 or 3 years' time.
Yeah, I think my two cents is I'm a big advocate. I think anything that, if nothing else, if it just removes the howlers out of the game and makes the game that little bit fairer, I think it's a good thing. As long as you know, it's always the usual thing. As long as what's happening at elite level doesn't distort or unfairly affect the way things happen at club level or at grassroots level. So, you know, we've all heard the stories of young players now making DRS signs with their hands when they don't like an umpire's decision, which is no different to outright dissent and things like that. So,
that's got to be eradicated. That, I mean, that, you know, that's in a game that hasn't got DRS. Anybody that does that needs to be completely stamped out. Particularly with the kids doing. I know they follow suit from what they see on the game, but I think coaches have a role and the parents have a role to say, well, it's appropriate when there's DRS at a game in a test match or in a one-day international, but it isn't here because it's not available to us. I think it's important that we do that as adults, because we need to look after the game as best we possibly can. The other interesting thing on DRS as well for me is LBW decisions for spin bowlers, because before technology came in, you know, people were kicking away spin bowlers and the spin bowling, it was gone. It was going out of the game. And then all of a sudden DRS comes in and you see the tactics change. You see Graham Swan trying to hit stumps more often than he did before, getting left-handers at LBW, you know, left, right and centre. And that's exciting. And we're now seeing that in county cricket, because people are beginning to give more and more LBs for left-arm spinners and off-spinners in county cricket. And you're beginning to see it in club cricket. And that can only be good because, you know, the bat's there to be played with. You're meant to hit the ball. And that's exciting cricket when that happens.
Well, one of our guiding philosophies on Pitch Vision Academy is that we should be encouraging spin as much as we can. So in that respect, I think everybody could get behind the idea of more LBWs, correctly given LBWs for spinners at every level.
Except when I'm batting.
Well, you never get hit on the pad, though, do you? I mean,
well, no. There's always a thick edge. There's always a thick edge,
and an incredulous look.
Yeah.
Okay, it's about time that we caught up with Gary Palmer in the second part of his interview that he did with us recently, and he's talking a bit more about batting coaching, and as usual, his opinions are strong. So let's catch up with Gary now. Say then, for example, someone is in a situation where they feel like a switch hit, for example, is the only shot that is going to work for them, because of the way the field's been set or whatever. Would it be a problem that they've not practiced it?
If you're going to play a switch hit, you're obviously a very, very talented sports person, hand-eye coordination and good ball sense, all the rest of it, right? If you're clever enough to do that, well, surely you'd be clever enough, or it would be easier for you to just come down the wicket and just do a good old-fashioned slog, or hit the ball more in front of the wicket, the conventional way. If you found someone was bowling so well at you, you couldn't hit the ball and they're bowling in the rough, you might have a sweep at it. But again, if you've been taught well and your technique is good, you shouldn't have to even go there with a switch hit. And when you say about the field placings, now, if you're going to take a risk to switch hit, it's a risk where you could get out. Why not just, like I said, come down the wicket and good old-fashioned straight shot or slog? Doesn't matter where the fielders are. If you're taking the chance to hit it in the air, you're going to hit it for six anyway. And if you hit it high enough, deep enough, it doesn't matter where the fielders are. So I think it's a bit of a posy shot, in short.
Well, of course, one of the problems that young cricketers face is that they get bored very easily. They don't want to have that discipline of playing the same shot over and over again and working on those basics over and over again. So what would you say to someone who, you know, was trying to have a bit of fun and playing the switch hit and not necessarily, you know, going in the nets to have a slog or whatever, but, you know, under the guise of, well, I'm practicing my 2020? What would you say to someone who had that mindset?
I'd say that you're probably never going to bat that high up the order. You're never going to be very consistent. You're never going to get a big 100. And you're not going to stay in the game long, because a real good player is somebody who has got a lot of self-discipline, a lot of concentration, will practice for hours on end, will be patient. You know, all those sorts of qualities you need to get, you know, 100 or 150 in a four-day championship game. And if you can do that, you should be able to change your mindset to be able to adapt to one-day cricket, 40-over cricket, 2020 cricket. But if all you can do is 2020 cricket, you're limiting yourself just to one type of tournament or match type. And, you know, it's a high-risk game, isn't it? You're very, very difficult to be consistent in batting in 2020 cricket. So, therefore, you may not, you know, if you're a professional player, or your contract may be very short. You might not be playing cricket at that level for very long. I think you've got to prioritise and do the basics first. The basics are a very good platform to actually attack and play 2020 cricket from. The more the full blade of the bat goes at the ball, the more you hit down the ground when it's pitched up. You know, if it's short and wide, you can cut it or pull it or hook it. That's the way forward. Why waste time, valuable time, when you could be perfecting your basics? Why waste valuable time practicing a switch hit? How many times are you going to play that shot in a match? Not that often. How many times are you going to play a forward defensive or a front foot off drive, straight drive, on drive? You're going to play that a lot. So those are the shots you need to be prioritising and practising. And I've said this before, if Viv Richards or Ian Botham were playing 2020 cricket, I think they would just play the same way they played John Player League 40-over cricket, but they would just score off more balls, but with the same shots. And I think they'd be highly successful cricketers.
Oh, you work a lot with young up-and-coming players who are trying to make it into the professional game, but you also work quite a bit with players who were already professionals. So do you have the same message for people who are already in the professional game than you do for people who are still learning the basics?
I think so. I think the principles are exactly the same. Yes, is the answer to that.
So give us an example of a session when you've been working with a professional cricketer. What kind of things you do that reinforces that message?
Well, just recently I was lucky enough to have two sessions with Michael Carberry, the Hampshire opening bat. Now, there is a player that thrives on hard work, thrives on repetition. He knows tactically, he knows his game inside out. What you would call a good old-fashioned true professional. He loves hard work. And the first session I did with him when he came up to Oxford, we were on a bowling machine for 4 hours. And it was 4 hours of intense repetition, attention to detail. I took him through a sort of unique session I do with players where I challenge his technique from every single angle on the crease with a bowling machine and swing. So it would be over the wicket, swinging away, swinging in, left arm over, swinging away, swinging in. So he got the opportunity to fine tune his technique against all angles and swings. And for me, that was also a way of trying to find out if there were any minute flaws in his technique. This was a really good way of trying to identify them. And when we identified a flaw in a particular angle, we would stick on that angle till we taken that flaw away and got him back to hitting the ball as near as damn it to perfection. And like I say, we hit lots and lots and lots of balls, massive detail on technique, made a few slight changes which would probably challenge what are in the textbook. But that's why he scores the runs he scores. He puts in the time and the effort, and where other players may go on a machine for half an hour, 40 minutes, with him, you know, he just keeps going and going and going and going. And that's the attitude you've got to have. And that's why he's gone out and scored a 300 and 180 because of his mindset, his work rate, his attention to detail, repetition. No, he's not interested in batting in the net, hitting too many imperfect slack shots. He wants them near enough perfection 99% of the time. So when he goes into the match, he's just working on feel of what's right and watching the ball and thinking about where he's going to score his runs. So the mind is quite clear apart from the job in hand. Better that to be going out to bat with, well, I don't know if my elbow's here. Should it be there? I've got to get my head there. But there's no shortcut. And like I say, his work rate is second to none. And he was quite happy to listen to new ideas, try new concepts, the ways of changing angles on the crease with the bowling machine for specific reasons. He was open to try and new ideas on technique, like I say, which would challenge what you read in the textbook and we've been taught. And in my case, that's when you're driving straight and particularly through mid-on, your laces and knees are pointing up the wicket and especially the back foot. And for working with him, that was quite key because turning that back foot in early allowed him to align and balance himself better when he played straight drives. It also allowed him to a better reach forward. So when the spinner would come on, you could play the ball out in front of your pad and turn a half-decent length ball into maybe a nice drive for two or four down the ground. And it also made it easier to take the bowler on and hit balls that weren't quite there back over their head for six. So, yeah, it was a pleasure working with somebody with that sort of mindset.
Time now for the question section on the show, and as you already know, the best question of the week has a prize, which is a online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com, and you can find out what the coaching videos and courses and worksheets and things are if you head over to pitchvision.com slash Academy and click on the links there to find out more information. But in order to get your free coaching course, you need to send in a question, which two people have done this week, and the boss has got those questions.
I have trouble settling on a trigger movement. Is there any way of being able to find the perfect trigger movement when batting? And this has come in from DG Martin. So, gentlemen, trigger movements. How do you find one that fits you?
Well, in my opinion, the first thing is you have to have a really, really good reason to be thinking about a trigger move in the first place. Because a lot of people, especially kids who are easily influenced, they see their idol on the television and think to themselves, well, I've got to have a trigger move like them. And they try it a couple of times and, they end up getting out, and then they try a trigger move like somebody else. And it becomes something like we talked about last week with that technical ADD. And it's never a natural thing. So the first thing I'd say is, what is your reason for wanting a trigger move in the first place? Are you facing 90 mile an hour bowlers? Because if you're not, do you really need it? Have you got a technical flaw that a trigger move might help you with? If you have, then maybe it's not the trigger move that is needed to sort out the problem. So the underlying cause would be my first thing. And my second thing would be, as a general piece of advice, without being able to see a batsman, then you can't really go too far wrong with a step which is back and across. You can't make a lot of mistakes with that. Whereas if, say, you are doing a forward press, you can get caught in a position where you're playing around your front pad, you're closed off. So if you're talking about percentage-wise, you know, not being able to see a batsman, not being able to make an individual suggestion to a batsman, I'd say probably the back and across is the one that gives you the best bang for your buck. What do you think, Mark?
Well, yeah, I slightly disagree with that, to be honest. Back and across was the first one that came in, and I remember being a player who was taught that. And sometimes that can lead to misalignment of hips and misalignment of shoulders, which affects your backswing. So you need to be aware that whatever you do with your trigger movement, you need to keep it in line. So if you have a look at a Kevin Peterson, you have a look at an Alistair Cook, even though they move both of their feet within their trigger movement, actually at ball release, they're still aligned properly. And the trouble with a back and across type technique is sometimes that can misalign you from your perfect starting position into a misaligned one at ball release, and that's the last thing you want to do. So as long as you end up being realigned at ball release, that's a good thing to do. As long as your body is fired up, then that's a good thing to do as well. And most of the players nowadays, most of the players in international cricket, their last movement is going forward, because they want all of their weight going forward into the ball. So you look at Ian Bell. I think Ian Bell has got a fantastic balance and tempo to his movements. He's obviously playing very well at the moment as well. But if you watch him, he's very, very well aligned. He moves across and makes sure he's still aligned at the time when the ball's released, and everything's going back into the ball. And if you can get that, you're not going to go too far wrong, because it gives you more margin for error of where you make your contact if your weight's going back into the ball.
A lot of this discussion is not, for most people, playing cricket, i.e. outside of the top level, it's just not relevant. Because if you've got a guy bowling at 60 mile an hour medium pace on a wet April track, the trigger move is completely irrelevant, and most people would just get in a tangle because they don't practice enough to be able to develop a proper trigger move.
Correct. And that's where the Matthew Hayden standstill, see it, react, hit it, comes into play, and it doesn't need to be any more simple than that. But it's when, I suppose it's for that kid, I suppose, that goes from playing, you know, under 16 cricket to first 11 Premier League cricket, and there's an overseas bowler playing. You know, it's that sort of jump that you're looking to try and say to somebody, well, the reason why, when the ball gets a bit cheeky in pace, that you look to get a trigger movement in, and you get it in before ball release, is to fire the neuromuscular system so you can move quicker. End of story.
Okay, so I think we've covered trigger moves. What's the next question, boss?
The next question is from Paul. And Paul asks us, you know, well, he says that I'm interested in learning the batting drills a coach can put a batsman through in the nets prior to batting in a game. So I guess he's not talking about practicing in the nets. He's talking about warming up during the game itself, straight before he goes out and bats.
I think this is quite a personal thing to the batsman, because having spoken to different people at different levels, everybody's kind of got their own way of doing things. Some people like to have a full net against proper bowling. Other people like to have a few throwdowns. Some people just like a few underarms. I think it varies quite a lot. I don't think there's a prescriptive thing you can say. Here is a list of five drills that you should do with every one of your top seven batsmen before the day's play. What do you think, Harris?
No, I agree with that. I mean, obviously, I've been in teams that have had all sorts of different types of batters and some blooming good ones, and they do things very differently. And Michael Vaughan was a big fan of having some underarm feed so he could get his drives away and hit off of one leg. So he'd be hitting off of his front leg and lifting up his back foot to get his weight coming forward and feeling that his weight was all going back forward into the ball. Kevin Peterson would be quite happy having some throws without pads on, just to feel that the bat was coming through properly without having to worry about getting his legs in the way and worrying, thinking about his bat path. Paul Collingwood would have a different set of things. Andrew Strauss would want to be challenged a little bit more and would quite like to have a couple of balls zinging around his ears. But as you say, David, it's very, very individual, and it's down to each batter to work that one out. And if we go back to last week's podcast, we talked about recipes and working out what your recipe is. So if you can find out what your practice recipe is, then be consistent with it. And if it's successful and it continues to be successful, don't let any coach that's come near you say, oh, why not try this, why not try that, if you're successful with your own recipe.
But if, for Paul's case, who I think he must be a coach himself, and I guess he may be having players asking him what's good, is the old traditional throwdowns on the bumpy outfield good or poor preparation, or are there any little things that you could suggest that he could just try out with some of these players?
I think one of the things that it was reported a little while back that England were doing was having batting buddies and pairing people together to do batting practice with each other, which is a good broader idea, but it's also a good way of getting players to work out for themselves what works for them. So rather than the coach say he's coaching an under 11s team and he's got to do something in that pre-match warm-up, he can get the players buddying up with each other and get them doing trying a few different things. One week they might try having a net, and one week they might try doing underarms and see what feels best, and they can work it out between themselves rather than the coach deciding that everyone's going to do one specific thing, because it might work for four people, but it won't work for another three of them.
It's going back to the question that you asked their boss, which was, is throwdowns on a rough outfield a good idea? It is if the player approaches it properly. And I can remember back to Chennai 2000 and what would it have been 2008, the match after the Mumbai attacks, and I went out with Kevin Peterson to do some throws with him, and there was Sachin Tendulkar next to me hitting some balls, and the outfield was really, really slow. It was stodgy, the ball was sticking into it, and he was playing a game of hitting the ball, didn't matter where it bounced, hit around as close to him as he possibly could. So even if the ball was sticking in the wicket, he wasn't just chipping it back up in the air like everybody else would do. He would wait for that ball and he would drill it back into the ground and see how many divots he had as close as he possibly could to him, because he believed that if he could control the ball on there, then he was going to control the ball on any wicket that he played on. And as it was, he went out and scored 140 in the second innings and won the game. So,
That's very interesting.
That was a really good way of using what was maybe not an optimal practice facility, but getting the most out of it.
And remember, if you have any other coaching questions, please email them in at coach@pitchvision.com or call in. We have an answer phone with all the international numbers that are listed on the website.
Okay, that is your lot for this week. Before we go, we have to make the monumental decision of who is going to win the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com from the two questions we have this week. So I think Gareth is probably in the best position to make that decision this week. Boss, what do you reckon?
Yeah, let him have the honour.
So Which question? Is it Paul's coaching question or DG Martin's trigger move question?
Well, I think just because of the fact that we had so much discussion about the trigger move, it does affect everybody. I think that the question from DG Martin on the trigger movement gets the vote.
Well done, DJ.
Yeah, excellent. And unfortunately, due to the time restrictions on the show, you will have got a very small amount of that discussion. But don't worry, if you are a trigger move fanatic, and I know there will be people listening to this who are trigger move fanatics, then I will take the completely unedited version of that discussion, and I'll put it into a separate podcast for you to be able to download, if you so wish, from pitchvision.com. So check that out as soon as you get back to your computer once you've listened to this show. As the boss mentioned earlier, you can send in your questions to us via email, and also you can phone in to the answer phone and leave your question on there. You can also get us on Twitter at PV Cricket Coach, and there is a Facebook page. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. Now, boss, let's give Gareth a bit of a test. Gareth, how would somebody find us if they wanted to subscribe in iTunes?
How would they find you? Well, you could go to iTunes and you could stick in Pitch Vision Academy into the search engine, and up it comes, because that's what I did.
Fabulous. There you go. So that is, it's as simple as that. Very easy to work out. And if you don't use iTunes, but you're foolish if you don't. But if you don't use iTunes, then you can find the feed, which you can put into any podcast catching program, on our website at pitchvision.com. We're going to go and have a look for Berners now, because he's missing in action. I'm not sure where he's got to. He's definitely still alive, boss, isn't he?
He's in Turkey.
That's the reports. But whether that's true or not, I don't know. When we uncover him, he'll be back on the show. And so until next week, thank you, boss, and thank you, Gareth.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Cheers.
David Hinchcliffe, and I'm joined this week by the boss and Mark Garraway.
One day you're going to include that in the outtake, aren't you?
Maybe this week.